We are with Sue Bradford and Ed McKnight this evening on the panel, and just such a large response. We're still collecting them actually, but results in about 2 minutes' time. Here's another one. I'm an ex-high school teacher, and I don't agree with the ban. In class, I often ask students to use their phones for activities, and certainly I could see when students were messaging each other. When everyone in my class has their laptops open, I can't see what they're doing like I could with phones. They are a super useful tool that we should figure out how to use for students' benefit. If anything, they should be banned just during the break. So results in 5 minutes' time. But I just want to sort of touch on this before we move on. This is the political poll out just over half an hour ago. New Zealand First would be out of Parliament, and Labour, the Greens and Te Pāti Māori would have enough seats to form a government together, according to the latest One News Virium poll. So National on 36%, down 2 points. ACT down a point to 7, New Zealand First down to 4, Labour up 2 points to 30, Greens are up 2 to 14, Te Pāti Māori steady on 4. Any thoughts on this, Sue Bradford? Any movement here, or is it just another poll?
Oh, well, it's actually quite a hopeful poll for those on the left side of the spectrum in Parliament. I think it's significant that it's just over 6 months since the government was elected. And that's quite early for seats in the House to shift in this way. And I think reflects, in the case of New Zealand First, the antics of one or two of their members, among other things, but also the whole onslaught that this government's engaged in. People aren't happy with it. I sometimes wonder how many of the people that voted voted National New Zealand First Act in the last election really agree with the bulk of what you're doing. I can't help but wonder.
Ed?
Do they really think that tax cuts are more important than police pay or having enough doctors and nurses?
Well, we've got an economist with us right now, Ed.
Well, I do have to be the boring economist and say, look, I wouldn't read too much into this. And the reason is because with any of these polls, you have sampling errors or margin of errors. And at the median, it's about 3%. So you're kind of saying National down 2%, ACT down 1%. I think it's about the same for New Zealand First. They're not massive movements. And so some of these movements can just be put down to statistical variation or sampling errors, as opposed to genuine movements in terms of how people are feeling. Of course, when it comes to MMP, 1% can make a very large difference, because we're talking about New Zealand First jumping under that 5% threshold there that you need to get some seats if you don't have an electorate MP. So look, I just caution anybody reading too much into this just yet, because you're well within the margin of error.
All right, very, very good. All right, and just to those snap panel poll results, just a sort of snapshot of where you're sitting. So people who said they're for the ban, for the cell phone ban in schools, 62% said yes, and 38% said no. They're against it. So 62% said yes, 38% said no. So people are overwhelmingly listening to the panel for the cell phone ban in schools. I was just thinking, though, Sue, an entire day, no cell phone? Is that a bit cruel? That sounds like a long time. I couldn't do that.
Yes, you could.
I don't.
I think it's great that people can focus on learning and communicating and interacting with each other in the real world without having, I mean, there's enough, there are, as someone has already pointed out, enough devices operational in the school already. The kids, or older ones, certainly have access to laptops and iPads and so on through the day. So it's not been completely cut off from the world of the net. But I think anything that can bring young ones back into the real world is and kind of relieve the addiction to the device is helpful.
All right, fair enough. And this person here says, look, no phones at lunchtime. That would mean the return of Bull Rush. And I don't know whether or not you played Bull Rush, Ed, but I'm old enough to actually recall the joy and sheer excitement when the bell rang, and I know that I'll be playing Bull Rush.
Oh, look, I think I was probably a bit too skinny to be playing Bull Rush. I would have got a couple of nosebleeds had I done that. But look, I think on the whole, it's probably going to be good. Kids need to be out there and socialising with each other, or even if they are a bit lonely, which you kind of brought up previously, Wallace, you know, you can always find solace in a library or a music practice room or something along those lines. And I've just been really interested in the comments around, oh, well, this ban is pointless because kids will just use Chromebooks or kids will just use something else. And it reminds me one of my favourite sayings, which is the slotted spoon can catch the potato, which is, okay, we're going to bring this ban in. It'll probably stop a whole heap of bad behaviour and will probably encourage some really good habits. Yep, some stuff will slip through, but the slotted spoon has still caught the potato.
All right, fair enough. Someone says, it's not an entire day. It's 6 hours, for goodness sake. Well, that's a long time. 6 hours. That is a long time. Long time for me anyway. All right, time for I've Been Thinking. Sue Bradford, take it away.
I've been thinking about a big family reunion that's coming up in Pyhare in August this year. My great-great-great-grandfather was Richard Davis, who was sent from Dorset in England in 1824 as a gardener and catechist for the Church Missionary Society, that's the Anglicans. He and his family were first based in Pyhare, then went on to run the mission farm at Waimate North, which Charles Darwin visited in 1835. I'm not usually big on this type of event, but given that it's 200 years since the Davis family arrived and some folks have put a lot of work into bringing this together, I'm planning to be there. I read somewhere that there are now approximately 12,500 people who are direct descendants of Richard and Mary Davis. So I imagine the organisers are not expecting everyone to turn up. At a time when tangata whenua and te tiriti o Waitangi are under threat in various ways, I think it's more important than ever that Pākehā like me understand who our forebears were and why and how they came here, as part of all of us coming to terms with their and our role in the history of this place. And I'm looking forward to discovering relatives I've met before and many whom I haven't. What kind of folk have the Davis descendants become? How do different ones of us see our role in this country 200 years after that first arrival, whatever our lines of descent? The reunion program looks really busy, as you might imagine, but one event that really interests me is a marae visit in which we're invited to break bread with whānau on that marae and reflect on our shared history across time and generations. And I think there are seeds of hope there for deeper understandings and a different kind of future for our descendants than some current political leaders seem to aspire to.
Good on you, Sue Bradford. Going to a family reunion, not usually big on those things, but Richard Davis arrives in New Zealand in 1824. Actually, that is really quite extraordinary, Sue. 1824.
Kia ora to all those relatives out there. I imagine there's one or two at least who are listening.
That's just amazing. That really is. It'd be interesting to hear, when you get back from it, to hear how it went. So, nice one. All right, Ed McKnight, what's been on your mind for I've Been Thinking?
Well, I've been thinking about how long I'm going to live. And it's quite interesting because my grandfather died in his early 80s, my grandmother in her 70s. And so I thought, well, you know what? I'll go look at Stats NZ, find out how long I statistically might live for. And the answer is I've got about a 50% chance of living to roughly 89 years old, and wait for this, Wallace, about a 20% chance that I'm going to live to 95. And that's got me thinking, oh my gosh, I'm about a third of the way through my life, about a quarter of the way through my work life. What do I actually want to do with the rest of the time that I've got left? And it's worth thinking about, I think, because there are two ways you could look at it. On one hand, you could say, well, isn't that terrible? I've only got 60 years or so left. Or you could think, well, isn't that wonderful? I've got 60 years left. What do I want to do with that time? And it's actually got me thinking about this phone ban we've been talking about on Radio New Zealand's The Panel this evening, which is I probably want to spend less time on my phone. That will be a great delight to hear for my partner. I probably want to spend less time on TikTok. I probably want to spend less time on Instagram Reels and probably doing more, can I say, meaningful work on my career and my business. I probably want to travel and see the world. And so I've just been thinking, for everybody out there, sometimes it is worth thinking, you know, roughly how long have I got left?
Good on you.
And what do I want to do with that time?
I can, what I was thinking of there, I was closing my eyes, what I saw was Ed McKnight sitting in a sunset in Vietnam, recorded for Instagram. There you go. That's you. That's what I saw. That's what I saw, Ed. Good on you. Happy life.
I'll share the TikTok with you.
The panel, RNZ National, coming up to 15 to 7. Lovely to have your company. Thank you for all your responses this evening and to this. The colourful Keep New Zealand Beautiful logo, recognisable to all. This is the organisation that gave us the slogan, Be a Tidy Kiwi. But now, 50 years after the anti-litter charity first launched, in dire straits. They've received zilch government funding this year, and if funding can't be secured soon, they say its free school programs would have to be shelved. They are second only to Forest and Bird as New Zealand's longest standing environmental charity. With us is the Chief Executive of Keep New Zealand Beautiful, Heather Saunderson. Kia ora, Heather.
Kia ora, Wallace.
Well, this isn't good news, is it? The second oldest environmental charity in the whole country, cash-strapped.
We are not living the dream right now.
How so? What's changed?
We were actually part of central government until about 1984, and then central government thought that we should become a charity because people would pay more attention to the work that we did. They gave us funding for the Do the Right Thing commercial that I'm sure everybody is familiar with. But we hadn't received any monies from central government for about 20 years until I came on board. I did a comprehensive review of what all of our sister organizations abroad were doing and put forward a strategy to then ministers Nick Smith and Scott Simpson. And that 2017 was the first time that we procured funding for over 20 years. And we had a three-pronged work stream. It was focused on two educational programs, a behavior change campaign, and a 2019 national litter audit. In 2022, we tendered for a three-pronged work stream again for $3 million, and we received $1.3 million for an 11-pronged work stream with a specific mandate to be in over a third of the schools in New Zealand.
Well, let's jump into our panel. They might have questions or solutions or comments about this organization. Ed, can you recall or do you know the Be a Tidy Kiwi slogan?
I think every Kiwi knows that specific slogan. It's everywhere. It's probably ingrained in a lot of our DNA because we've heard it so much. Now, it's fascinating to hear, Heather, that you guys had no funding from the government before 2017, so it's only been in place for the last 6 years. I must admit, I did go and look at your financial statements on your website, which are public. I could not believe how little revenue they Keep New Zealand Beautiful charity actually has. You guys are really reliant on a lot of volunteer work. How many volunteers turn out and help to keep New Zealand beautiful?
Everything that we do is free, so I guess that's what separates us from other educational providers. And let's say, for example, Cleanup Week last year, we had over 67,000 volunteers, and we provided free kits to everyone. So we're more focused on social equity, and believe me when I say I've looked at the financials instead of the board, oh my God, like we need to. But it's about ensuring that everyone has access to these types of programs. So we are more focused on marginalized communities or communities that wouldn't otherwise have access to environmental education.
And Wallace, if you just think about 67,000 Kiwis getting out there as part of that initiative, that is more or roughly the same amount as the number of people who live in New Plymouth.
It's a significant number, isn't it? 67,000. Sue Bradford, do you want to pick up on this?
First of all, good on you for the work that you've done and continue to do. I am struck by the fact that your organisation was originally set up by the government, because it's not often where a charity is set up from. Mm. And that actually this should be government, you've been government funded all along for the sort of work you're doing. But I fear that what you're talking and what you're going through right now with your colleagues is part of a much wider situation across the community sector of groups not receiving the funding they were from either government sources or from other philanthropic sources. Things seem to be really tight. And I fear that this government and other philanthropic sources don't understand that it's all very good to say, well, this is wonderful environmental or social community work that you're doing. It's great that you're mobilising volunteers. It's great that you're teaching people in the community about X, Y, and Z. But not understanding that unless you've got at least a skeleton infrastructure that's paid and supported, all those volunteers cannot be mobilised. So I fear that it's part of a wider trend and that all of us who are part of the community sector need to do everything we can to try and change things.
I want to know, Heather, because it's quite a, in the court of popular opinion, this would be quite a big one, because no one likes to see their community, their street, their little stream, their local stream, their local river or estuary. No one likes to see it full of plastic or junk or tyres and such like. Do you know if litter in this country is worsening?
I guess I'd like to say two things. First, to your question, in 2019, we did New Zealand's first comprehensive national litter audit, where we were in every council and we looked at parks and recreation, retail industry, industrial, railways, highways, residential. So this was, you know, working alongside Stats NZ and MFE and DOC. In 2022, we repeated that, and every material classification, so for every piece of litter that we had collected in 2019, we had this comprehensive list of. Every piece of litter had increased with the exception of cigarette butts, and we found vapes in 2022. And illegal dumping increased by two-thirds. So, yes, considering that was during a large part of lockdown, etc., I would say that the problem has gotten increasingly worse. And to Sue's point, I completely agree with you. There are a lot of charities struggling. I think the difference is that this government keeps speaking about, you know, financial restrictions and pulling back, and they're actually funding another environmental education charity to the tune of $1.9 million per year until 2026. And we received $220,000 per year for a two-year contract.
Mm. Just finally, before you go, Heather, because that Be a Tidy Kiwi slogan was so successful and it's ingrained into, you know, growing up, it's just this little wee sort of psychological tick to remind you that as you're going past the rubbish bin to put on your chalk wrapper, do we need an upgrade? Maybe there is an upgrade. I don't know.
I think the problem is that central government invests and then they stop and then they go back to a charity and they say, well, what happened? And it's like, well, you invested in us doing this big, large scale project and then there's no funding for a few years and then the problem gets worse. So I don't necessarily know that it's a Be a Tidy Kiwi thing per se.
Oh, right.
I think that resonates with most New Zealanders. I think it's a lack of continuity.
Okay. Hey, very good. Hey, thank you for your time, Heather. Kia ora. That's Heather Saunderson, Keep New Zealand Beautiful Chief Executive. They are, by the way, the second longest running environmental charity in this country, second only to Forest and Bird. How about that? It's seven away from seven, the panel. Now we are with Ed McKnight and Sue Bradford into this. Over 1,000 people showed up on Petone Beach in Lower Hutt yesterday to make their voices heard regarding plans to demolish its historic wharf. The wharf was damaged and closed for repairs after a series of earthquakes a few years ago, leading to the proposal in Hutt City's Council's draft long-term plan. And the community walk was organised by Save Petone Wharf Group. They're encouraging people to make submissions on the proposal before they close on the 3rd of May. With us is Helen Ritchie, former regional councillor and a former deputy mayor of Wellington. Helen, nice to have you here.
Oh, thank you, Wallace. It's lovely to speak to you again.
Well, I was looking at this. So here we have this structure built in 1890, rebuilt in 1906. The good people of Petone must be very close to their historic wharf.
Well, yes, they are, and I was asked to lend a hand and I'm very happy to do that. You know, it means a lot to this community, which is an up-and-coming heritage community, if that's possible. It is a structure, of course. It's the second longest wooden wharf in the country, next to Bluff, I believe. So it has got a status, and a heritage status, but I also think it's not just the history, it's also the future and the use for future young people, for future generations. And also, I see heritage actually as stories as well. That's why it is his story or her story. So it's not just the structure, it's also the stories that are around that structure.
Hey, let's go to our panel. Well, you spent a bit of time in Wellington, so do you think this is a nice to have in history, or do you think it's actually quite important to try and preserve this this wharf? You might have even been there.
Oh, I think it's absolutely imperative that the wharf is saved. So good on you, Helene, for supporting the locals on this, and good on the locals for rallying. They're saying that it would cost $6 million to replace the wharf. They've got costings on that. The council, I think, is saying that it would cost $6 million to destroy it. What a wonderful amenity. What Helene's dead right about keeping these things that are of historical significance and are a focal point in their community. I just think it would be a real act of vandalism to go ahead and destroy that, to destroy the wharf rather than rebuild it.
Okay, stay there, Helene. Ed, what do you think? Bring in your economist lens.
I can't believe that $6 million repair cost is at all credible. I understand it's a very nice idea to say, well, it's $6 million to rip it down or $6 million to repair it. But I just can't see how that would actually be the case. You know, down here in Christchurch, people were saying, oh, it's only going to be $60 or $70 million to repair the cathedral or $60 to $70 million to build a new one. And now all of a sudden we know it's costing $250 million to repair the cathedral. So, Helene, is that $6 million estimated cost to repair the wharf, is that really credible?
Well, it's my understanding that the group have received technical advice as to how they can actually repair the wharf for that figure. And I don't think you can compare the wharf to Christchurch Cathedral at all. And I would have to say, as a former councillor and so on, or even as a ratepayer or whatever I am at the moment, that $6 million is peanuts. It's not going to impact on the ratepayers one iota, except that it will be to their advantage, because you'll have children, elderly people, families, able to stroll, to picnic, to jump off, to fish, to do manu. But the most important thing to me, or one of the most important things, is that it enables, and it did enable, the ferry, the electric ferry that we have in the harbour, which crosses to Eastbourne and so on, to stop there. Well, I think Simeon Brown might well look at this and think, well, this is a really good project compared to the underground tunnels that he is thinking of, which don't even compare to the Christchurch Cathedral.
Interesting. Oh, well, so submissions closed 3rd of May. We'll be keeping an eye on this, Helen, because I know how important it is to the good people of Petone. But for now, kia ora. Thanks for being with us. Helen Ritchie there, former Deputy Mayor of Wellington. Do you feel really strongly about... do you hate wharves, Ed?
Thanks, Sam. That's great. Thank you. Bye.
No, it's not that. But what I think is, well, if it's $6 million to repair or $6 million to pull it down, why is the Hutt City Council wanting to pull it down? I think there's probably another side to the story that should be looked into.
Do you think that sometimes our heritage is taking precedent of good common sense, Ed?
No, but I do think that people read a little bit too much into it. So you're saying it's the second largest wooden wharf in the country. And I do, I mean, I'm not from Petone, so I can say these kinds of things. Maybe if I lived in Lower Hutt, I might feel a little bit differently.
All right.
But I think, oh, it's the second largest timber wharf. Is that really that special?
And on that note, Sue Bradford, Ed McKnight, Thank you both. Great show. I'm Wallace Chapman. Stay with me. I'll be with you till 8 p.m. on RNZ National.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.